as well, I want to take one second and ask everyone to fill out the survey that should pop up on your screen today after the webinar is over. You'll also receive a link via email tomorrow to access the survey. Participating in the survey helps me develop content that's what you're looking for and finds the speakers that you want to hear from. So please take care of that. With that, let's spend a few minutes talking about the release of the proposed rule. As many of you know, the CFPB today released its proposed debt collection rule. We're not going to spend too much time on it today, but I'd be remiss if we didn't address it in some way, shape, or form. Among the highlights, the proposed rule is meant to establish a clear, bright line rule limiting call attempts and telephone conversations. The proposed rule will generally limit debt collectors to no more than 7 attempts by telephone per week to reach a consumer about a specific debt. Once a telephone conversation between the debt collector and consumer takes place, the debt collector must wait at least a week before calling the consumer again. The rule also clarifies consumer protection requirements for certain consumer-facing debt collection disclosures. The proposed rule would require debt collectors to send consumers a disclosure with certain information about the debt and related consumer protections. This information would include, for example, an itemization of the debt and plain language information about how a consumer may respond to a collection attempt, including by disputing the debt. The proposal would require the disclosure to include a tear-off that consumers could send back to the debt collector to respond to the collection attempt. The proposed rule would clarify how debt collectors may lawfully use newer communication technologies such as voicemails, emails, and text messages to communicate with consumers and would protect consumers who do not wish to receive such communications by, among other things, allowing them to unsubscribe to future communications through these methods. The proposed rule would also clarify how collectors may provide required disclosures electronically. In addition, if consumers want to limit ways debt collectors contact them, for example, at a specific telephone number while they are at work or during certain hours, the rule clarifies how consumers may easily do so. Finally, the proposed rule would prohibit a debt collector from suing or threatening to sue a consumer to collect a debt if the debt collector knows or should know that the statute of limitations has expired. The proposed rule would also prohibit a debt collector from furnishing information about a debt to a consumer reporting agency unless the debt collector has communicated about the debt to the consumer, such as by sending the consumer a letter. With that, what I'd like to do is go around the panel and give each of them, give each of our panelists a chance to share any thoughts, initial thoughts, you know, because the rule is about 3 hours old and 538 pages long. Any initial thoughts about what they've seen or read so far, or any perspective about the impact of their proposals may have on the credit and collection industry. John Bedard, would you mind going first?
Thank you, Mike. Sure, I'd be happy to. Look, industry wanted a validation notice safe harbor, they got it. Industry wanted ways to use new technology, email, text messaging, they got it. Industry wanted clarity on call frequency, they got it. Industry wanted clarification on how to disclose balances, they got it. Look, there's a lot in here that the industry was asking for that these proposed rules provide for. That doesn't mean, however, that it's going to be easy to do what the Bureau is suggesting would comply with the law. I have not sort of digested all of it myself, but at my first pass here, is that a lot of things that industry asked the Bureau to address, it addressed. That's my take.
Awesome, excellent, thank you. Boy, you're up.
You bet. The one thing I guess that pleases me to see is the idea of should have on the statute of limitations issue. That's an issue that I've lost all too famously over the years, trying to get more courts to adopt that should have. Particularly for my attorney clients who get sued for the statute of limitations issues, this could be a welcome change.
Boyd, what do you mean should have for those of us who haven't gotten to that section yet of the 500 and whatever pages?
Right. The it looks like the rule is going to say that if the debt collector knows or should have known that an account was past statute. That would be a violation because I've had too many judges saying, well, it looks like strict liability. You missed the statute, therefore you're liable. And I've been trying to convince courts, no, there's enough courts that said, a should-have standard should be applied, but not every court was applying it. Some courts, including those around me in the Midwest, have sometimes adopted, it was strict liability. Mm-hmm. So now maybe we've got no longer a strict liability, but a should-have known. So it would give lawyers a chance to make reasonable arguments to say, I don't think the statute expired because of these reasons. Even if I'm wrong, I should not have known I was going to be wrong. It was an unsettled area of the law.
That brings up a good question, though, too, because then it to me means, well, is it still a bona fide error analysis then? Are we still like back to that type of standard? Or is it a lesser standard that we don't have to rely on anymore? And I think that's just one of the questions that have come up as you're reading the rules and kind of trying to work through them. There's still going to be a lot to determine about, you know, how exactly to comply, like John mentioned. I even think the communication rules are kind of interesting with limiting the one communication and the week span. You know, what if the debtor requests a call back the next day because they're out of work? You know, they don't work the next day. That's when they want to talk and they request a call back. So would something like that be prohibited? I think there's, I think we all welcome the clarity. I think there's still a lot of questions out there.
There are some exceptions in the document, some scenarios that the Bureau actually lists. And that's one of them, Nicole, that you mentioned. Where the call restrictions would not, where the collector would be exempt from the call restrictions if the debtor asks someone to call, you know, asks you to call back a few hours later or the next day, the collector would be able to do that and not be subject to the call back, according to what I've read so far in the proposed rule.
And that just warms my heart because I feel like a lot of the things that I'm reading here is John Bedard was kind of listing out, you know, the industry wanted this, and here it is in the rule. Like, I really feel like the CFPB listened carefully to many of the things that the industry and the industry advocates have been asking for years now. And it's pretty exciting to see that they took our feedback. You know, when the proposed outline came out, if you remember, the contact restrictions did not specify call. And now in the proposed rule, we see that the contact restrictions are specifying call, one call per consumer, per account, per day. That's great that they were able to be that clear and that specific, and then to have, you know, really detailed feedback, which we're all reading through right now, that kind of outline different scenarios and what their approach is to that. And so I think it's going to take a while for everyone to read through it and think through it. But one of the things that we as an industry need to do is submit feedback to the Bureau throughout the entire thing, because this is a notice of a proposed rulemaking. They are asking for our specific feedback about these ideas. And since we know that they have taken that into consideration in the past, because we're looking at it here, right? The proposal said nothing about email or text. And this has email like 636 times the word email is mentioned in this 500-page document. I want to make sure that I know that our industry associations are going to do a very thorough job responding for us, but as companies who are working in this area, we need to make sure that we also take the time to send the CFPB a note on any provision that's really concerning to us and provide, you know, reasons as to why and research as to why, perhaps even data to help them in the rule. You know, just because we see it here now doesn't necessarily mean you should adopt this practice immediately. Nothing's final. But it's exciting that it's here.
Excellent. Well, with that, what I'd like to do is I'd like to thank them. Thank our panelists for taking a few minutes to talk about the proposed rule. I'm going to invite Jack Gordon from Web Recon to say a few words, and then we're going to proceed to our discussion on call baiting. Jack?
Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for coming to this webinar. I was the lucky sponsor who got the day that the new proposed rule dropped, so I'm very happy to be here to to help bring this moment to you. And we just heard from four really, really smart people in this industry who gave their very, very preliminary takes on this. So very exciting. Web Recon, as a sponsor, obviously, we are knee deep in call baiting issues here. A lot of people who try to bait your collectors into violation or alleged violations of these very rules that we're talking about today, they are the frequent filers that we can identify. So if you have a problem with call baiting, if you have a problem with frequent filers, if you're just getting sued too much, I hope you'll reach out to us after the webinar and see if maybe there's something we can do to help you with that. I am going to shut up now because I want to hear what these great people have to say.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Jack. And thanks again to Web Recon for sponsoring today's webinar. Really appreciate your continued support. So let's talk about call baiting. Let's first talk about what call baiting is. Kelly, maybe you can walk us through a definition.
Absolutely. So call baiting is a technique, I suppose we could say, used by consumers and or their attorneys to goad a collector or an agency into violating the law. So they tee up a scenario where they are asking specific targeted questions that the answer to that question, just answering the question in and of itself, would be a violation of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. And because it is a strict liability statute, unless you can prove a bona fide error, which again, you would have to prove, you know, the answer to that question, if it's not answered in compliance with the FDCPA, would be a violation. So it's baiting you and your collectors into violating the law.
And the reason that someone would do this, you know, is to your point, it's a strict liability statute. Someone is just looking to try and profit off of a collector's error. That's the main reason.
Absolutely. And then they send you a demand letter or they file a lawsuit stating that you violated the FDCPA. So one of the most common ones that I hear is, you know, the person on the phone that's trying to gut your collector to tell them when the payment is due. When is this due, right? And they're asking that question during the validation period. Because courts across the country have generally found that a demand for a payment statement that, well, this is past due, this is due immediately during the validation period overshadows the validation notice that we provide in our initial communication. And that the CFPB says we can provide in emails in the proposed rule. Yay, that's very exciting. So, you know, I think collectors need to be trained on call baiting and what they can listen for and anticipate when they're getting these questions that, you know, are targeted to create a violation. And I will tell you that I have spoken to consumer attorneys and I have read pleadings and cases that I'm sure everyone presenting can also share with where consumer attorneys state that this is a strategy that they use with their clients, right? So I've had someone tell me, oh, I was on the phone when this happened, so I know that this happened. Or, you know, we have the transcripts where the consumer plaintiff's attorneys, you know, or their clients said, oh yeah, my attorney told me to do this. And once you have that violation, the chances are you're going to settle it rather than fight the case.
I think it's also kind of interesting too. My personal thought is a lot of these claims originate through credit repair organizations or credit counseling, and they come up as a, hey, you want a way to get these accounts off your credit report or resolve these debts and have to pay nothing? Here, let me send you to this attorney that's going to show you how to do that. I think that's how it comes up. In a lot of scenarios, in Illinois and most of the Midwest, we have a firm that's based out of Chicago that is doing a really aggressive call baiting initiative here on debt that is barred by the statute of limitations, also known as time-barred debt, where because of some of the case law we have here out of the Seventh Circuit, they specifically and pointedly ask the collector certain questions about the debt's enforceability or collection on the debt in order to goad the collector into basically making a request for payment without disclosing that it may restart the statute of limitations, and then they sue on it. So interestingly enough, this is actually a scenario where many times there's actually been, these are dormant accounts. So the only way that you would be able to even, you know that a collection agency is associated with the account is because of some type of notation on the credit report. So my thought is that these originate from those types of credit repair organizations, at least this type of claim. But that's the biggest call baiting scenario that I'm seeing here now is questions about statute of limitations.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Kelly, we had a question come in, and this is a chance for me to remind everybody, if you have a question for our panel, type it into your Q&A window on your Zoom webinar control panel. What would the collector's correct response be when a consumer asks, when is my payment due during the validation period?
Right. So I think that my advice would be that any due date that you are going to give should be outside that validation period time. So for example, if you are mailing your validation letter, you need to allow for time for the consumer to get that validation letter in their mailbox, because remember, the FDCPA says that it's 30 days from the date the consumer receives that notice, right? So, you know, if you want to add 7 days, you know, plus 30, so 37 days from the date that you mailed that letter, that would perhaps be a good practice to use if you're going to specifically give a date. That's something that, you know, I would recommend as a best practice. I don't know if anyone else, you know, would recommend something different. John, Nicole, Boyd?
The proposed rule actually identifies 5 days.
Ooh.
So the Bureau thinks 5 days is enough time for the consumer to receive what the collector sends, right?
Great.
Yep.
I think there's a bunch of different things you could say in response to that question, though, without giving a date specific. I mean, technically, the account is already in default or past due. I mean, I don't know that there is a specific due date anymore. I don't know how my other panelists feel about that statement.
This is Bedard. I think there's a misconception by debt collectors that they are required to always answer a consumer's direct question. Mm-hmm. And I am perfectly happy if clients simply explain to consumers that the amount is due, and to help the consumer understand what that amount is and how they might be able to make payment without taking the bait, so to speak, by saying something or doing something that allows the consumer to then accuse the collector of having said or done something wrong.
Okay, so if I'm the consumer and I call you up, John Bedard, and I say, when is this due, how would you respond?
Well, you know, our creditor indicates that the past due balance is $250, Ms. Stevens. Can I help you make a payment today on that balance?
Well, I want to know when it's due.
Well, I mean, of course, you can go back and forth with them all the time about that. Yeah. But, you know, I have a catchphrase that I tell collectors far and wide to live by when they learn and when they begin to see the hallmarks of a bait call on the phone. And you just actually identified one of the hallmarks, which is the repeated questions or the interrogation. And I tell collectors all the time, when the bait gets shown, get off the phone, right? Because there is no other reason for that consumer to be talking to you other than to try and get you to spring the trap. And I tell clients all the time, don't spring the trap. When you learn or when you sense that the only purpose of this call is to get you to screw up, get off the phone. You're not going to get a payment. And in fact, what you might be doing is increasing the risk of some claims against you or the company. And so when the bait gets shown, get off the phone.
Agreed. This is Boyd. I guess what I've traditionally counseled people on, what I've worked with is be humble. If you're a collector on the phone, be humble and say, I don't have that information, right? I'm not sure. I'm not certain of that right now. What I can see is ABC account for $50 has been placed with our office. How would you like to resolve that? How would you like to deal with it? Whatever, you know, can I help you set up payments or something to move back to the conversation of, are they interested in making a payment, or are they throwing you these questions that a collector should not have on a screen, right? A field is populated date due, right? They should not have that. They probably don't see it. They shouldn't be given that much information.
Yeah.
And inbound call particularly.
I think John Bedard and his, if the bait gets shown, get off the phone, is a really good rule of thumb to live by, because when the person keeps, I had this situation happen to me, and before the question kept getting asked, when is it due? When is it due? The collector, you know, did give the response, well, this is past due, you know, the account went into default on such and such a date. You know, but the person kept demanding, you know, a date. So in order to help answer that question, you know, we give a date certain that's outside that validation period. And then if the person keeps asking the question, transfer that person to someone or get off the phone with them. You know, if I can't help you by answering further questions, you know, I've told you that, you know, the due date is such and such a time.
And this is Bedard. Just like Boyd said, there is no shame in telling a consumer, I'm sorry, I'm not able to answer that question. But what I can do is, and then whatever it is you can do, you can help them make a payment. You can help them get more information about the account. You can help them contact the creditor. Whatever you can do. But there's nothing wrong with telling the consumer, I'm sorry, I'm not able to answer that question. But what I can do is, and then keep going.
Yeah.
Now, Nicole,
so we have some other, go ahead.
I was going to ask you about the out of statute stuff that you brought up, especially in light of some of the other questions that are coming in, because I've also heard that, you know, there's only a couple of states that require an out of statute disclosure to be read orally over the phone, like New York and Massachusetts, New Mexico are some of them off the top of my head. You know, are you, since this is the next area of baiting, are you now recommending for your clients to give an oral out of statute disclosure in states that don't require it?
Yeah, I think you have to, really. But this is very circuit dependent. So the answer is going to be different whether or not you're in the Seventh Circuit or the Sixth Circuit versus, you know, a circuit that only requires the disclosure if you're threatening litigation, something like that. So most of these claims are originating out of the Seventh Circuit because of the Bantoja decision. We don't have anything, the last time I checked, that made this particular requirement in an oral conversation, but I think what the Seventh Circuit would decide is kind of clear on the issue, that they would find that you would need to have that disclosure. But it also, I think, is very fact dependent on what was said during the call. We're litigating this issue quite a bit right now, and part of the argument that we're making is that we're not required to make the disclosure because we're not attempting to collect a debt. Like the statements that were being made by the collector, you know, didn't include a demand for payment. We were just passively answering the consumer's questions, and so thus it doesn't require that disclosure. So I think there's some room even in the Seventh Circuit to try to, you know, beef up the issue. But yeah, I think the better the better policy right now is to just come up with a disclosure that adequately advises the consumer regarding the statute of limitations and whether or not a partial payment would serve to toll the SOL. So you're going to have to look at what your state law is on your tolling issues. You're going to have to look at what the courts have said about what works and what doesn't work to come up with something right. And it may vary per state. Like Kelly, I know we've discussed this before. What is it, like New Jersey about partial payment tolls?
Yeah, so it's not just a partial payment alone in the state of New Jersey. There's like 20 states where a partial payment alone will not reset the statute of limitations. And so this whole area is super duper thorny. And you need to make sure that you have a really good set of disclosures that perhaps have been reviewed by your outside counsel that you're reading. But we've recently moved to reading an out of statute disclosure on any state in light of the additional baiting calls.
We have another question here about call baiting. Any baiting associated with I want to dispute, do I need to dispute in writing or anything similar? I see that all the time. I don't know about you all, but that was more of an old tactic as opposed to a newer tactic. I think a lot of agencies kind of became wise to that. But again, that depends on what circuit you're in and whether or not you're beholden to Graziano or not, I suppose. But yeah, we see that all the time. Do I have to dispute in writing?
Yeah.
Sure. Go ahead.
No, Boyd, you go.
Thanks. Those are probably the first series of call baiting cases I had that originated from one particular courthouse filed by one particular consumer attorney. We filed them over and over and over and over. And I thought, my goodness, how did this happen, right? And, you get one of them in a deposition and you get the sheet, right, where here's the questions asked and here's the call log to fill out. And I don't see that one much anymore, particularly. The whole question is about credit reporting, right? How long is this going to be on my credit report? How would I dispute this on my credit report? Or how should I dispute orally in writing? Those are easy, I guess. They look like something maybe easy to deal with from maybe a layperson's perspective, but boy, those are bait every time. Too enticing. We just got to stay away from answering those types of questions.
So you're not
I was going to say, I actually have one client that is charged a particular collector with responding to credit report questions. And so she is particularly trained to answer questions about credit reporting. And that's how they handle that. So if someone starts asking detailed questions on credit reporting, they forward it to her. And she is responsible for asking all the questions because she knows most of the answers or is pretty schooled in it. Seems to have worked out well for them.
And does that agency credit report?
Yeah.
Okay. Would you recommend something similar for an agency that doesn't credit report?
I don't know that you're going to have the same questions really come in for that, but in that circumstance, I would probably just say it'd be sufficient to say you're going to have to discuss that with the creditor because we're not credit reporting. So it's going to be creditor dependent. I would just refer them back to saying we don't control that. That's controlled by the creditor.
Yeah. And that's a pretty common, as Boyd was saying, it's a landmine question. It's an easy question for someone to be given as a baiting question because, we know the CFPB had a bulletin about, using credit reporting in bad ways and responding, trying to get a customer to pay for getting the credit report, properly updated or whatever is something that you want to avoid. And so these questions are designed to get you to fall into that trap, although not necessarily because someone could also actually be asking those questions because they want to know. Having that scripted is really important and training your collectors on that because that's another place you're going to have a ton of questions on that. We don't credit report. So our response, unless our particular client gives us some sort of a response, is to, you know, let people know that they need to get in touch with either the original, the creditor who's doing the reporting, or the credit reporting bureaus themselves, because as we don't credit report, we don't have the specific details about that. We know that our client, we communicate with our client about payments that you are making, and they communicate that, you know, to the credit reporting agencies.
We have another question that came in here. What is the best way to handle a person who keeps calling back after you know that you are being baited?
Close the account. Send it back to the creditor. Yeah, I mean, I would say close the account. And so when this person calls back in, you say your account's closed. Goodbye. I wouldn't have any more communications with them.
And, you know, this is one of the places where it's important, if you are, you know, using a litigation scrub product, you can help identify these call baiters very early on. Because these call baiters are the folks that are going to be your litigious debtors. So if you're running a litigious debtor scrub, you're already identifying the folks who aren't going to be making payments, but instead going to be taking up your collector's time and energy. So it's best to just close those out.
Going back to what we were talking about earlier with regards to the payment question, I'm not sure if we covered this. If we did, I apologize. But someone asked, can't you just say the payment is due as soon as possible as an answer to when the payment is due?
Not when you're inside the validation period, you're not going to say that.
I'm not sure I'd ever say that, really. Just I don't want necessarily want my collector on the phone making that judgment or making that decision.
Right.
I don't want them to think about that, and I really don't want additional training on that particular. I just say you know, move it back to, you know, develop a phrase like, you know, John was suggesting, how, and let's get it back to what I'm going to make us money, right? What's going to turn us into a successful call.
Yeah, but you're never going to turn a baiter into a successful call, so.
Agreed. And so if they don't want to take the bait back of how can I turn this into a payment, they're not interested in what you have to offer on the phone, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's when so if they come back to that question, but no, I need to know this first, that's when you say, okay, you are not a successful call. I got to get out of here. You are baiting me. Instead of answering the question directly. I'm not sure I would ever say jump on it. It's due right away, even outside the validation period, because, you know, why would a consumer admit that, you know, they needed that, right? Why would they say, yeah, I needed to know when it's due, and they've already got letters, right, from the creditor, they've already got calls from the creditor, probably already received inbound calls from the collection agency.
Yeah, another thing you can do is you can sort of turn their question into another question. Well, when can you make a payment? So that you're not actually answering their question, but instead you're turning around and offering them, you know, the opportunity to tell you, get to the bottom of their situation. And that's when, again, you'll find out if, you know, they're just going to circle back on you. Because if it's really a consumer that's asking you because they need to know and they're trying to figure out, you know, when the payment is due, when they can line it up in light of their other obligations, right? If they're really calling in because they're trying to understand that, then they'll engage with you and not keep asking you the same question over and over again. And so then you'll be able to differentiate, okay, this is a call baiter, or, you know, someone who's not interested at all in making a payment, or this is a consumer who's calling in because, you know, they have something else going on in their life and they're trying to figure out when they can fit this in to their, you know, schedule of other things that they are trying to, other obligations, other debts, whatever. Yeah, that's a good
question. I'm curious. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to ask, because I've heard this before, you know, does a litigation scrub risk a fair lending issue? What do you guys think about that? That question came in. Are you treating someone differently because of their use of a consumer protection statute? What do you guys think?
I don't think so, if you want my short answer.
Can you make your short answer a little bit longer?
Well, I mean, I think it's kind of a detailed analysis, and I don't know, do I qualify as a lender under that scenario? Am I really treating them in a materially different manner? I've thought about this before, and my ultimate conclusion is no, but that doesn't mean that someone's not going to make the argument. I don't know what other people think on it. And also, I will say that I don't know that this is a large risk anyway, because this literally wouldn't be something that I could see a consumer attorney advancing, maybe some type of disparate impact, strange analysis by a regulator, but it just seems kind of far out there.
Well, in one sense, you could say they're being treated differently, right, based on their prior conduct, right, maybe taking advantage of a consumer statute. But I guess you'd have to look at, is that different treatment negative? Is it preferential treatment? I guess it depends on what lens you use to view it, right? Is receiving contacts from a collection agency useful? As we would often argue, hey, this is, they're useful, right? These calls are going to resolve things and keep the economy going. Or would, you know, people on the other side of the V in our cases say, oh, it's terrible to be contacted by debt collector. It's so harassing, right? And so I guess it depends on what eyes you look through it at. I'm not sure it's negative treatment to not get a call or a letter, or a text.
I'll take a shot at it. There's no question in my mind that a debt collector does not violate fair lending by using, by scrubbing litigious debtors. Whether or not a creditor is implicated by that behavior is a different question. I conclude the answer is still no, because we have to think about who are the protected classes. As far as I'm aware, somebody who has filed a civil action in court is not specifically identified as a protected class in any statutes that I'm familiar with. In addition, these fair lending laws are really focused on the origination of debt, not necessarily all of the downstream, servicing of it. There are aspects of those laws that do implicate servicing. So I don't mean them to be completely exclusive to origination, but I just don't think those are the kind of consumers that are intended to be protected. And I don't think not sending, just like Boyd said, depriving consumers of the opportunity to be contacted by debt collectors is not the kind of behavior that I think the law prohibits.
Another question that kind of relates to that is, if you are using the litigation scrub, do you still attempt to collect? Do you automatically close them out? What different strategies are employed with that information?
I think the whole point would be to close them out, right? I mean, obviously, you know that this debtor's filing actions under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, and as we just know from an industry standard, I mean, my personal view is they're probably never going to pay. So I just don't think it's the risk of paying out the settlement or defending the action for, tens of thousands of dollars, perhaps, because this debtor, there's a slight chance the debtor will pay.
I have a different take on it. We've got clients who use this litigious debtor service to identify those accounts that they are not interested in investing pre-litigation resources into. And so instead what they do is they take those accounts and they have a legal strategy that those immediately go into so that they can overcome the risk that we're talking about in this seminar right here, which is call baiting. They can avoid the potential of this litigious consumer actually getting the collector to step on a landmine or spring the trap. And instead, they take that information and they use that information to drive collection strategy, not necessarily to just shut accounts down and not collect the accounts.
I think that's interesting, John. I have a lot of clients that are attorneys in law firms, and so they get sued a lot for, you know, stuff that happens in state court litigation too. But I guess that would make sense if, you know, as an agency, you're not concerned with, you know, a debtor bringing some type of collection litigation claim.
There have been a couple of questions that come in asking which kind of companies do the scrub we're talking about. Well, WebRecon, the sponsor of today's webinar, is definitely one of them. You can go to webrecon.com. To learn more about the company and get a phone number and give Jack a call to learn more about the service and sign up for, I think he's got a free trial as well. One question did come in. I'm curious if anybody can discuss the effectiveness of a litigation scrub like what RevRecon offers. I mean, how effective are they at identifying and sort of ferreting out potential litigants, such as people who are going to be trying to bait collectors on the phone? Anyone want to jump at that one?
Yeah, I'm not sure that we can know for sure. It sort of depends on the strategy that you're employing. So if you are closing those accounts, I think the way you could probably evaluate it would be to look at the numbers between, you know, the average number of lawsuits being filed against any given. Well, now I'm going down a rabbit hole. I think that you're just shoring up your risk. You're limiting your risk if you're doing that kind of scrub and, you know, closing out those sort of opportunities. Or if you're looking at it and deciding, you know, we're not going to make outbound calls on a call baiter or whatever policy you develop around it. I feel like my boss probably has done numbers to show how it's super effective because he's the numbers person. And I'll see if I can get some of those for you before the end of this. Does anybody else have?
This is Bedard.
Yeah.
Well, it's very difficult to measure the number of lawsuits you have avoided because you have been smart about choosing the accounts that you're going to work. I submit to clients, however, that if they've avoided even one, then they have, by a multiple, saved the cost of actually using some data or information like a litigious debtor scrub to make those decisions.
Well said. I'm curious how you would advise companies train their collectors to sort of spot call baiting. You know, is it just sort of reinforced, you know, sort of role playing? What's the best way to train a collector to be able to spot a situation where they may be being baited? Boy, do you want to talk about that one first?
You bet. Absolutely. The method I think I've probably used most with my clients is actual role playing, right? The compliance team set up these role play calls, go through a series of these questions, right, and see if the audience can spot them. I'm not sure I've really seen it on written methods of testing, right? You know, is this type of question call bait or not? It's tough in a vacuum. Right. I think it's that initial give and take that is helpful to recognize. But I'd be curious to hear if others see any other method for identifying this other than, the role play.
Yeah, so we like to train, and in the past and other companies I've worked with that, run call centers specifically on call baiting so that collectors are aware that it can happen. I've used tape recordings of calls where we've later been sued that we believed were the result of call baiting to help everyone listen and understand that the questions are going to be very simple. They're going to be potentially a common question, but they're going to keep getting asked. There are other things that you can listen for. You can listen for people whispering, hearing other voices on the line, odd pauses, weird times, where it just seems like the individual on the phone is consulting with someone. And I can understand where a consumer would be very nervous to call and talk to a debt collection company, you know, based on past experience, perhaps, or some perceived notion of what a debt collector might be like that would give them angst, where if they did have an attorney, perhaps they were considering filing bankruptcy, it would make them feel more comfortable to make that call in their attorney's office. So, you know, that might be something, you know, pretty normal that happens a lot where, you know, the collector might hear, you know, whispering or something else. But those are the things that folks should be listening for and should be a part of your training so that they can identify when someone else is there. And I've actually said, you know, if you hear that happening in the background and, you know, there's no, oh, is someone else on the call with us? You know, there's no reason why you can't, you know, ask that information, get that information out there. But then again, you know, just making sure that you're identifying that call. If an attorney's on the phone with them or an attorney's calling in to address something, you know, you might have a manager policy where things are getting directed to a collection floor manager or maybe your quality assurance team, just to make sure that, you know, everything's following the script and the way that you want those questions to be answered. Because, you know, for example, whether or not you credit report, if the creditor is credit reporting, you're going to get questions about credit reporting. And it's possible that a consumer is very interested in the answer to that question because they're selling their, you know, buying a house or buying a car, whatever. And so, you know, you need to have a scripted answer to those sort of things in advance and you need to train on them. So it's really one, training on identifying call baiting and what the process is when you've identified it and key factors to identify. And then two, identifying problems situations where you want to make sure that you have a scripted answer that everybody knows to go to when they're getting those questions, when it's specifically about disputes. How can I make a dispute? Can I make a dispute over the phone? If you're getting questions about, you know, when is my payment due? If you're getting questions about, you know, how is this going to impact my credit record or my credit score or, you know, how long will it take before my credit is updated? Whatever, all of those things.
Excellent. We have a question again. What is the best response if a consumer asks, what will you do if I refuse to pay?
I usually say, I don't know. Or that's what I tell the collector. I don't know. That's up to the creditor.
Well, if it's a refusal, so you wouldn't go down the path of, well, if, you know, you're refusing to pay, I'm going to mark your account as a refusal to pay. It's going to get closed at my office. We won't contact you again. It will be returned to the creditor. And yeah, that's a good point. Then I'm in trouble. I don't want to get into what that might be.
I just try to, I don't know. A lot of my advice in this area is less is more. And so, you know, you can't be faulted for not knowing the answer to a question. And I think sometimes collectors have this tendency to want to seem just ultimately knowledgeable on so that they gain the trust of the consumer. And I think usually that's in those cases is where the collector gets him or herself in the most trouble because they start talking about things that they don't know the answers to. And so when somebody asks a question like that, like, what will you do if I refuse to pay? I don't think anyone can fault the consumer or the collector by saying, I don't know. Because ultimately, they probably don't know ultimately what's going to happen. But I don't think that's going to be a misstatement that you're going to get sued for.
Okay. Are there examples of call baiting other than during the validation period? I know we've talked about a few. Are there any others that you want to mention before we wrap up?
Yeah, Mike, this is John. And which is related to the call, to the question that we just answered. I mean, I would ask a client how many times a consumer has paid their account after the collector has provided a satisfactory answer to the question of what are you going to do if I refuse to pay the account? I mean, it's like, to me, that is immediate red flag, and it's a hallmark of a bait call, right? Consumers who you are communicating with that have an intention of paying the account never ask the question, what are you going to do if I refuse to pay the debt, right? I have never, ever in my experience heard a client tell me that they got payment after a consumer has said those words.
Yeah.
I also, with respect to what other kind of bait calls sort of happen out there, I have what I call my list of hallmarks. What are the hallmarks of a bait call, right? I tell clients to be sensitive to the inbound side, right? It's an inbound call from a consumer, not necessarily an outbound call. Be particularly sensitive to those. If the consumer is on speakerphone or there's a third party involved in that telephone call that the collector can discern, like Kelly was talking about a few minutes ago, I tell clients that's a hallmark of a baiting call. Be careful, get the antennas up. If the consumer's reading from a script, look, we have all been on the telephone with people, and we can tell the difference if somebody's reading from a piece of paper or not. We know what it's like, what it sounds like for people to read to us. And so if they're reading from a script, that's a hallmark. If the consumer is interrogating the collection agent, right, that's the hallmark of a baiting call. If the consumer misstates the words that the collector speaks, right, if the collector says something and then the consumer attempts to repeat or restate what the collector said and misstates those words, I think that's a hallmark of a bait call. We talked earlier about repeated questions, right? When the consumer repeats over and over again the same question because expecting to get a different answer. You know, consumers who will accept no answer as a satisfactory answer. All of those things, I tell clients, are hallmarks of a bait call. And by now, you've heard it from me. I won't say it again, but everybody knows what to do when the bait gets shown, right? There's just no good reason to continue communicating with that consumer.
It looks like we have a credit reporting question up there too. As a reporting agency, we also remove debt once paid. This takes 30 to 60 days. How would collectors express that to the consumer? When the consumer gets more specific, i.e. what exact date, which bureaus, and when should I check? Do we want to open up the pay to delete discussion with 2 minutes left?
I think so. That's another webinar, right? That's another webinar.
Yeah, I think we can just say that there's a whole list of reasons why pay to delete may be problematic for you in general, aside from just answering questions. So yes, another day.
Excellent. Well, we, like Nicole said, we've only got a couple of minutes left. I think we've tried to get to as many of the questions as possible. There have been a large number of questions that have come in, more so than usual webinars. So I appreciate our panel being able to handle these on the fly, because most of them weren't part of our discussion topics that we were planning on talking about today, but I do appreciate that they were able to handle them so deftly. But before we wrap up and let everybody go, what I'd like to do is go around the panel one more time and give them a chance to share any any thoughts they didn't get a chance to talk about what but wanted to bring up or summarize what they talked about today, or any other takeaways that they want to share with the audience before we wrap up. So if you don't mind, maybe take a minute and do that. Boy, would you mind going first?
You bet. What I usually tell my clients is stay humble. You won't know everything. If you don't know it, feel free to admit that, right? Stay humble. You don't have to be aggressive or know everything to be in control.
Awesome. Good advice. John?
Identify the bait. Don't spring the trap. Get off the phone. There you have it.
Very succinct. I love it. Nicole?
I would say my one shortest piece of advice would probably be to tell your collectors it's okay to say, I don't know. Because guessing never helps anybody.
Good advice. Kelly?
I think what I would say is that, you know, if it happens and you fall into the trap and you listen to everything and you feel like you have a good case, like your collector really didn't violate, apply for industry advancement funds, fight that case. I think that courts, when they see, you know, how some of this goes down, might help get us decisions in our favor. And I think a jury probably would agree too.
Excellent. Well, join me in thanking John, Kelly, Nicole, and Boyd for their time, not just on call baiting, but an impromptu discussion on the release of the proposed debt collection rule from the CFPB, fresh, hot off the presses this morning. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us today. I also want to thank Web Recon one more time for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.webrecon.com to learn more about the company. Thanks again, everybody who participated and asked questions. We tried to get to as many of them as we can. A recording of this will be made available on accountsrecovery.net probably within the next hour or so. So you can check that out if you're looking to access a recording. And I hope everyone enjoys the rest of your day. Thank you very much. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, everybody.
Hey.
Thanks. Bye now.